This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by MidSIM, the best way to get cheap 4G LTE data in the US. Use offer code ACFREESHIP for free first-class shipping on any MidSIM purchase, and check out the new MidSIM app in the Google Play Store. Hey, everybody. My name is Daniel Bader, and this is the Android Central podcast for December 15th, 2017. Yes, I'm back. No, I'm not tanned. Let's not talk about it. I'm joined this week by three advocates of net neutrality all the way across the pond. Alex Dobie, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
I'm talking to an advocate of net neutrality.
We do have that over here. Thanks.
It is a thing.
Over
in the land nothing, of the free.
Nothing that happened necessarily affected him.
Well, it did affect you. Andrew Martinick, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm about a third of the way through my cup of coffee, so I'll get a little more lively as we roll through this, because this is a morning podcast for me. Okay.
True. Speak yeah, you are 3 hours behind.
It is 9:24 a.m.
Alex, are you 4 or 5 hours right now?
We're back from East Coast. We're back on 5 right now.
Oh, okay. So it's the pitch dark of night.
It sure is.
Where you are. Well, I think it's snowing in our two cities, Russell, Holly.
It is.
Are you snowed in? Are you comfy?
No, we just started getting snow, and I think we're only going to get like an inch or two. But because I live in Maryland, that inch or two was enough to close schools in the middle of the day.
Shame.
Awesome. Well, I have just returned from Hawaii, where it didn't snow anywhere I was, funnily enough. But I did get to talk to a couple of smart people from Qualcomm about some cool new silicon that you guys did talk about last week, so I'm not going to bore you too much. But I thought it would be fun just to kind of go over a little bit more about it and talk about 5G, because that's a part of the conversation that you guys didn't talk about last week. And I had an opportunity to talk with some people from Qualcomm about it. So what do you say? Let's talk 5G?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Uh-huh. So... Uh-huh, exactly. That's a good starting point. So at the summit, this is Qualcomm's second Snapdragon summit. The first was in New York in 2016, and they decided to do it a little bit, I think, warmer, better overall in 2017 in Maui. And the showcase announcements were obviously the always-connected PCs, in collaboration with Microsoft and HP and Asus, with computers essentially running Windows 10S powered by the Snapdragon 835. And the second day was all about the Snapdragon 845 and the improvements there, including support of faster LTE. But on the third day, there was a lot of kind of high-level talk about 5G. And 5G is this thing, and Russell, you talked about this on the site several times, about nobody really knows what 5G is yet. It's just this kind of ephemeral thing that we keep referring to. It's getting closer and closer as the year and years progress, but nobody's really sure how it's going to like manifest itself. And I think we got a better idea of it at the Snapdragon Summit, if I'm correct. Would that be right, Russell? Like, in your mind, do you think of 5G as something that's still kind of very much abstract?
Yeah, it's definitely this vague thing. I mean, I guess at CES last year, the talk of 5G was almost like a mesh network, because it wasn't just, you know, a direct line of providing internet communication from a source to a device. It was about using this kind of internal network around you to also kind of gain network superiority and clarity, connection to services. So that was this kind of really bizarre, fascinating thing that didn't have a lot of shape to it. It was just this, you know, kind of, hey, this is a thing that will be great later. And I guess... we got a little more clarity from Qualcomm here, but it's still not something that I feel like is at the very least the way that they're pitching it feels like a complete thought yet.
And it's actually, if you look at the transition from 3G to 4G and the transition that we're going to get soon from 4G to 5G, it isn't really going to be a case of one completely supplanting the other, the way that, you know, your 4G coverage, actually the area that you could cover geographically with 3G was roughly the same as 4G, or actually even better with 4G, because you know, the spectrum that was used. With 5G, we're still looking at, and correct me if I'm wrong, Daniel, but we're looking at, actually, for wider area coverage, you'd still get back on the 4G network. You'd still fall back onto that for relatively high speeds, but over a wider area, right?
Exactly. So what's really interesting about the keynote that Qualcomm gave, and I have to preface this by saying that 5G is being championed by Qualcomm, but it's not, Qualcomm is not the only company involved in the process. Qualcomm is working with many others, from the carrier side to the vendor side, like Ericsson and Huawei, to make the actual equipment. But Qualcomm is advocating for 5G largely because it had a very big stake, or it has a very big stake in the success of the technology, but also it's helped shape the standard. And we're currently in this sort of, if you remember, you know, 802.11 N, or 802.11 G, N, AC, for a long time, those were not standard. They were not set standards. They were kind of like working standards. And 5G is that equivalent right now. It's a working standard there. We've hit certain milestones, but it's not complete. So that's the disclaimer that I have to say. But you're absolutely right, Alex. So the way that 5G is being envisioned right now is that it's all about capacity, and it's actually going to rely very heavily on 4G. In fact, when 5G rolls out in 2019, 2020, it will 100% rely on 4G, in the sense that 5G will not work without 4G. It's being positioned as a simultaneous connection, meaning you will be connected to both 4G and 5G at the same time, and the carrier will choose which service to give you data on. So for example, it will determine if you are in within X feet or if you're within the space that 5G connection will give you, it will then offer you that capacity. When it first rolls out, 5G will be basically sub 6 gigahertz. It'll be working sort of in like the 3.5 gigahertz range, which provides more capacity than our current 4G LTE networks. And eventually we'll be working with millimeter wave, which is like in the 29 to 38 gigahertz range. And the higher up in terms of frequency you go, the much less distance those signals travel. So you need to amplify them with larger antennas, or you basically just need to be really, really close to the base station. So 5G is going to work by having these small cells, and Andrew, you've talked about this before. Mm-hmm. Small cells are proliferating all over the U.S. in big cities, especially like Seattle, where they have to boost capacity, maybe around stadiums. You know, when your soccer team loses, obviously people are leaving the stadium, and you know they're sad and they want to tweet about it. And you know, they have to connect. And if there's not enough capacity at one of those towers, Sprint or AT&T or Verizon or T-Mobile will have these small cell base stations surrounding the stadiums that offer greater capacity. And 5G is basically being envisioned as a way for service providers to just like plop on a 5G modem or a 5G antenna where a 4G one sits today and provide like 100 times the capacity.
So here's an interesting question. Right now we're used to seeing, you know, 3G or H or 4G up in that top right corner. Considering the way that 4G is, the way 5G is being planned, that you don't always get that 5G connectivity. It's just about where you are. You still fall back on 4G sometimes, but it's about what your carrier thinks makes sense as to what you actually connect to. What are you actually going to see up there? Like, are you going to see 5G just when there is 5G available, and not necessarily when you can use it? Because
I bet if you're on AT&T, it's going to say 5G up there all the damn time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's kind of what I was hinting
at. 5G up there like next month.
Oh, we're talking real 5G, not fake 5G. But yeah, so did they address that at all, Daniel, as to how that's going to be positioned to your average person who doesn't necessarily understand all these technical ins and outs?
Yeah, they haven't addressed the way that it'll be shown on the phones themselves, although Qualcomm does have a reference 5G device running its X50 baseband modem. And when it launches, it'll actually be slower than the current fastest 4G LTE chips today. So right now, the Snapdragon 845 supports 1.2 gigabit speeds with five times carrier aggregation. And that is very, very fast. 5G will, the X50 chip right now only supports gigabit. So 1 gigabit a second.
Only a gigabit? Why bother?
Right. But by the time it launches, it'll be up to 5 gigabits. And the way that it's working right now is that, if you can basically, like, say you want to stream a movie or something from YouTube, if you have access to 5G, it'll just stream it using 5G, and that you will fall back on 4G if necessary. But 5G is only for data. Like, it will only be used for data for the foreseeable future. They don't even have an idea of voice over 5G. Like, they have something in place maybe for like 2025, but for the first like 5 years or so of this spec, it will just support data, because it's taken for granted that we will continue to have these very mature LTE networks that all of which support VoLTE. So, you know, we were talking about this yesterday, Andrew, about how Verizon and T-Mobile are really moving towards like a pure LTE network, where you don't ever actually need 3G to fall back on. But that's not really true, because there are pockets of the U.S. where you won't get an LTE signal. And even if you do get an LTE signal, you can't make a phone call over LTE. But 5G actually needs a 4G LTE signal to support both data and voice. Otherwise, you can't make a phone call.
They address any of the battery issues around that? Because if you're doing this, all this on top of your existing LTE connection, surely there's no way that it's not just going to use more power than pure LTE would, right?
Well, that's the thing. So what's really interesting is that they saw what happened with WiMAX and with the first LTE devices, right? Back in 2011, 2012.
Remember that HTC Thunderbolt back in the day?
That was probably one of the worst experiences. And the HTC Evo, what was it, the Evo 4G running WiMAX on Sprint?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Those things lasted like 3 hours maximum. The last thing Qualcomm wants to do is be responsible for a regression in battery longevity, especially given the gains we've made over the last 4 years, right? So that is 100% being taken into account. The issue, though, and they showed us some really interesting diagrams about this, the issue is that with millimeter wave, you need such a sensitive antenna to pick up those very, very thin, tiny wavelengths of microwave spectrum, that they have to do some really funky stuff with the antennas in the phones. And they've done that. I mean, they've got usable prototypes right now, and they're making it better. But that, I think, will be the biggest concern for the consumer, is when you buy those first 5G compatible phones, will there be a battery regression? I would say there probably will be for a generation or two, but I don't think it'll be as, you know, like, I don't think it'll be as noticeable as it was going from 3G to 4G, because that was just a train wreck.
Of course, there are battery savings to be had anytime you improve reliability and speeds, just from the standpoint of not having an active data connection for as long, or, you know, having a stronger data connection means that you're not ramping up just having a tower closer to you immediately means the antenna is not using as much battery. So the deployment of all these small cells helps a ton in that respect.
Exactly. If you're connecting to something that's in the same room as you, even if it's on like 6 gigahertz or something, that's going to be, there are going to be savings there compared to trying to blast through like a wall and an outside wall to a tower that might be all the way down the street.
So one thing that 5G is taking into account is this idea called massive MIMO. And we've heard of MIMO. It's multiple in, multiple out. It's this idea of sending data across multiple streams at the same time. So if you have two antennas in your phone or four antennas in your phone, two of those could receive and two of those could send at the same time. And there's an efficiency there. Massive MIMO, you are essentially sending out hundreds of carrier streams at the same time. And it bounces off windows, it bounces off cars, it does everything it needs to do to get to your phone. But it also intelligently can send data to more than one person using that same stream. So if Andrew and I and Alex and Russell, we're all sitting in the same room, but we're asking for different data, the tower and the carrier uses kind of algorithms and beamforming antennas and things like that to send you data using just one of those broadcasts or one of those signals. And that is extremely efficient in terms of capacity for the tower. And because ping times and latency are so much lower on 5G, that's exactly right. You get enormous savings in terms of power that way. But obviously with first generation technology, that may be offset somewhat. But eventually, yes, 5G is going to be incredibly efficient. And ultimately, it just comes down to like, and this is the thing that Qualcomm stresses, and I'll leave it here because, you know, I've taken up too much time already. 5G is eventually going to make things cheaper. Like, you think about how carriers are holding on to these kind of like, and we'll talk about this with net neutrality a little bit, but, you know, they're trying to offer unlimited plans, but like take some of those perks away. The idea behind 5G is that bits are so cheap and that capacity is so plentiful that carriers will be able to offer truly unlimited data without actually, you know, making these like very fine, you know, terms and conditions, or like adding all this fine print, no throttling, none of that. And that's sort of this ideal, right? This perfect scenario where carriers are like, yeah, we can offer so much capacity, but I mean, they're going to have to compete somewhat, you know, in other ways. So that's going to happen, but that's the dream, is that you'll be able to get a truly unlimited plan for much less money and always be connected.
And that's the point at which, you know, maybe we're looking a few years down the line, especially with a country the size of the US, where maybe you reach feasibility in terms of just being able to have that 5G connection that just does everything, and suddenly you don't need to have cable running to your house anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll see. I mean, that'll be something to talk about. The early specs of 5G included Wi-Fi in that. So essentially, the idea behind 5G from like back in the day was that it would supplant Wi-Fi, is that it would basically work with the existing Wi-Fi standards to like form, as Russell mentioned, this like big mesh network where everything talks to everything. That's not what first generation 5G is going to be. It's very much a mobile focused technology. Second gen 5G will obviously include IoT. It'll make everything, you know, it'll be much cheaper for your toaster to talk to your car and blah, blah, blah.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. So, I mean, you definitely want that, but that's down the line. So I don't know. I mean, I'm excited about it. I'm kind of one of those tech geeks that likes to listen to all this stuff and imagine the possibilities of what can happen. But then you realize that there are companies involved, and companies need, you know, to honor shareholders, and shareholders want companies to make profits. So, you know, we'll see.
The infrastructure challenge is still huge when you're talking about the range of these early 5G systems as well, right?
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, we're going to be holding on to 4G, like traditional LTE, for many, many, many years, which is good, because 4G is actually, we're getting to a point now where it's pretty fast. It's pretty reliable. Andrew got, what is it, like 232 megabits per second on T-Mobile the other day?
Like 235 down and 45 up. And that's not a one-off thing. There's certain pockets of the very touristy part of Seattle that T-Mobile is just completely beefed up. And it's a regular occurrence to get 200 to 300 megabits down.
Yeah. I mean, that's amazing. And that's something that, I mean, the Note 8, I think you were on the Note 8, right?
Yep.
Yeah. So the Note 8 supports gigabit, but the one that you use is the unlocked version, and Samsung refused to pay for the extra, two spatial streams. So it doesn't support 4x4 MIMO. It supports 2x2 MIMO, which means that if you had been running a carrier version, which, you know, the carriers pay for that extra, those extra streams, you could have gotten more speed. But that, I mean, these are kind of like, these are all business decisions. T-Mobile wants to advertise that it has the fastest network, so it'll pay Qualcomm for access to those, you know, to those extra few megabits. It's fun.
Oh yeah,
it's fun nerding out. Why don't we nerd out on some Pixel AR stickers, Russell? What do you think of that?
So here's the thing: Google showed us AR stickers the day before the Pixel 2 launch, or they showed me the AR stickers before the Pixel 2 launch, and having been using AR Core on the iPhone 8 for a couple of days before that, I was really not super impressed with what I saw. Like, it was cute, but the demonstration was clearly not finished, and they made it clear that it was not finished and that they were going to take their time to get it right. And the end result is, on a technical level, very impressive, and actually blows away just about any other AR Core experience that I've had on the iPhone X. It's really, really surprised me how much work Google put into lots of little details around this. But for those who don't know, AR stickers is a new feature inside of the camera on any Pixel phone running 8.1. And it gives you augmented reality creatures from, Star Wars and Stranger Things and a couple of, home-cooked things that you can drop into a camera shot and either snap a photo of or record a video.
So let's talk a little bit about the technology behind this, because, you know, I've tried it. I think everybody here has tried it. It looks pretty good. I mean, they're using AR Core to power these AR stickers. And you don't need it's not super sophisticated in the sense that you don't need to do a whole lot with your phone to get the stickers working, but there are shadow effects and stuff, right?
Yeah. So one of the things that makes this as functional as it does is it actually relies on camera sensor data to figure out where the light sources are in the room, and uses that to put those light sources on whatever it is that you're taking a picture of. So it creates this greater feeling of realism, where the shadows are actually pointed in the same direction as the real objects in the room or outside, and the lighting matches as close as Google can approximate right now to what the lighting would be on a real thing in that room.
Obviously, this is a pretty exciting new feature, but where does this go? Like, how does Google sort of make this something that people use on a regular basis?
I mean, the biggest thing that they've got now for this, camera thing is just making it, this is a competitive thing in the same way that, Facebook's camera has augmented reality things and the Snapchat camera has augmented reality things. This is just another play in that direction, where there is a group of people, it is certainly not everyone, that likes having these kind of extra things to toss into their photos when they go to take them or when they're editing them after. And there are already lots of apps for, editing a photo by tossing stickers and stuff on top. But this is, these are animated creations that go deep into video, which very few other apps do particularly well. They a lot of times they end up having a lot of death map problems and not using a death map at all and just kind of guessing. So it's really cool to see Google putting this attention here. I also think it's Google making it very, very clear to developers who have been just flooding Apple's App Store with augmented reality apps that you can get, a very, very similar, if not better, experience for this stuff on these Pixel phones. So you should bring your stuff over to Android as well.
Okay, so why are they only supporting the Pixel 2 right now? Is it a, is it a Pixel visual core thing, or is it just a hardware speed thing, or is it possible that this would come to other phones?
They, when, you know, they were asked in just about every possible way that they could be asked, and Google made it clear that this was something that was just going to remain exclusive to the Pixel phones for now, and they weren't going to offer a better explanation. Part of me thinks that the reason for that is that it is built natively into the Google Camera app, and so could rely on Pixel Core for stuff. I know that if you read the review that I did of AR Core, I opened up the Star Wars thing for AR stickers and just filled a train station with Porgs from the new Star Wars movie.
I love that photo.
I've seen a lot of those.
I tried really hard. Like, my goal there when I was doing that, I was trying to break the camera app. I was trying to, like, how many AR objects could I put in this thing to where my phone just went, no, I can't do this anymore. This is too many. And I couldn't seem to find a limit. And the end result was kind of this hilarious little video of all of these Porgs everywhere. But some of that is probably, you know, going to rely on, you know, Visual Core here in the future. I don't think it is right now, but it's, you know, probably also got something to do with being able to create that depth map, because it's entirely done in software. It's not using another camera like Apple is doing with the iPhone X and iPhone 8 Plus. This depth map is entirely software based, and doing that requires Google to have the camera itself be a known quantity. And to make it work well, that camera also has to work really well in very specific lighting conditions. When you put those two things together, the Pixel is kind of an obvious choice given how well it handles low light and given, you know, how much work Google has gone into tuning that camera. I wouldn't shock me to see some kind of deal where AR stickers show up on, you know, the next Galaxy phone, you know, given how closely Samsung has worked with Google on the AR Core beta that has been out for developers. But I think that it would be a really long time, if at all, before this rolls out as just a general app for people, because the camera has to be so specifically calibrated for this to work as well as it does.
Yeah, I mean, the cynic in me and many of the commenters, the cynic is... I'm the commenters here. Why do this? This is stupid. These are resources that could be spent making other cool products. Why would you care about Porgs on a train station, on a train platform? And you know that there is, I suppose, a little bit of merit to that. I completely disagree, because we'll talk about it in a moment. But Porgs are they're fun.
Especially now.
But really, like, why is Google doing this? Like, what is the financial or business incentive, other than, say, competing with Snapchat and Facebook, to embed something like this in its camera app?
I mean, when you consider how many users Facebook and Snapchat have, it's not unreasonable to put some of your product into competing with them. And we're already seeing Google continue to push forward with the miserable bombed out failure that was Allo, in order to continue that competition going. It's very clear from Google's actions over the last year that having products that compete directly with these things are important, because they keep people tied into the Google ecosystem in some way. And that's an important thing for Google to continue to have access to this data. And to, you know, keep these users doing something. It's also not a terrible way for Google to maintain relationships with all of these massive pop culture icon companies like Disney Disney and Netflix and you know, whatever other Saturday Night Live, I think, is also releasing an AR sticker pack in the not so distant future. So, I mean, it gives Google, you know, an additional way to tap that kind of pop culture resource. I mean, there is no way in my mind that I see, you know, before the year is over, an AR sticker pack that features, you know, the bright blue dragon that breathes blue flame from the end of Game of Thrones this last season.
Whoa,
you know, showing up as a sticker. No, sorry. There are dragons in Game of Thrones. Big shock. But yeah, so I mean, like, there's no way we don't see that sticker pack when the next season of Game of Thrones come out. Like, where you can have the dragon just kind of sail across the sky.
Look, it's not crazy to think that Google wants to try to be, you know, make its products, especially making this exclusive to the Pixel, a bit more, like, hip and in the conversation beyond just smartphone nerds or people who are in the know with, you know, top-end Android phones. They want to be popular in wider aspects of how people enjoy their phones. And like it or not, these are the kinds of things that the mass market that Google's trying to get onto its Pixel phones like to be involved with. And like, this is a, you talk about this using up resources. I mean, how can you even know or quantify how much engineers are spending?
Have you seen what this company does on April Fool's Day?
Exactly. Especially compared to Russell's perfect example of like trying to do a whole new app platform like Allo. I mean, this is just such a smaller thing, and it can just like, it can bang out the hits and like get a bunch of big names on board and just get right in there right from the start. And I mean, I think I put AR stickers more on the line of like, look at what Google did with Gboard. It put in all of these extra features to be able to send, you know, be able to make Google searches in Gboard and search GIFs and send them into any app that accepts them just by, you know, sliding in there and putting that feature into the keyboard. This allows Google to have this cool thing, bake it into the camera itself, rather than trying to hop over that huge barrier of getting people to switch to a different messaging platform or a social platform. You know, where are we seeing all of these AR stickers? We're seeing them, you know, on Twitter. Like, Google didn't have to invent another failed social network. It just had to put this into the camera app and then let people share it where they already do. So I don't see this as being some kind of massive bet that Google's, you know, putting a ton of weight behind.
It's also a case of whether it's Google, the platform holder, or Google, the smartphone manufacturer that's doing this. Which hat is Google wearing when it's doing this AR sticker
thing?
It was pretty clear to me when they announced it alongside the Pixel phone. So this was the hardware division. This was them deciding, okay, this on our phone, this is going to be a differentiating feature. This is going to be a cool thing you can do on the Google phone. We as Google, a hardware company, are going to do this. And it doesn't really have much to do with Google as the company that also makes Android.
It's also important to keep in mind that, you know, on the list of silly things that Google invests money in, there is always some kind of underlying purpose. My favorite example of Google spending just a tremendous amount of money on something that seems perfectly silly is the Santa Tracker app that gets updated at the 1st of December every year.
Yeah, and is anybody complaining about that? How dare you make this magical time for kids?
People have, yeah. I mean, I've seen just about every time I go, hey, by the way, the Santa Tracker app is back and it's got 100 new features to it. There's always someone in the comments going, I can't believe Google spends so much time on this when they could be spending it on this other thing. Google built the Santa Tracker app specifically to drown out people who were using the Microsoft Santa Tracker app 6 or 7 years ago. And they just keep pumping features into it because this time every year, everyone uses it and it ties them, especially now, to mini games that are entirely baked into the Google ecosystem and Chromecast, sharing that gets used, you know, right in front of families who probably don't have Chromecast and then they go home and buy them for themselves. Like this, it all ties back into Google's ecosystem. So it is 100% worth it for them.
So my question is, anecdotally, Alex, do you think that the Pixel 2, with its slight, like, it's a more attractive phone, it's obviously a better phone than its you know, predecessor, but do you get the impression that the Pixel 2 is outselling considerably the original Pixels, or is it still kind of a niche product? Do people know about it?
I mean, that's a really hard question to answer. On the one hand, yeah, it's still kind of a niche product, and people have gone to great lengths to try and judge how many Google sells in the past year, including incorrectly pulling numbers from the Play Store to try and get a feel for how many are actually sold. In terms of just general awareness and advertising, I think, people are generally aware of it more so than they would have been a Nexus phone. That was the same this year as it was last year. Or there's been the same massive marketing push over here. I was at Euston Station in London a few days back, and that was just plastered full of Pixel ads like it was last year for the original Pixel. I think it's a slow build, but obviously there's a ton of marketing money being poured into it. They have E behind them as the exclusive carrier over here again. Carphone Warehouse, Pixel is a huge presence there as well. It's hard to judge the sort of the progression from Pixel 1 to Pixel 2 and what kind of gain has been there. I think only Google probably knows that. But for now, it's at least a flat line. Maybe it's going up a little bit. I'm not sure. But it's still a niche product. There is a massive amount of advertising money being pushed in so that people who might otherwise buy a Galaxy phone or buy an iPhone, that is at least on their radar. But I think it's going to take another couple of years before we know, if there's actually momentum building behind the Pixel phones for the average consumer, at least over here. That's the impression that I get.
Anecdotally, I have friends that are not, tech savvy. They've bought Pixel 2s. Mm. I see them around a little bit more. We talked about this with the Nexus 6P and things like that, even after the Nexus 5X and 6P came out, I saw more Nexus 5s than anything else. And even after the original Pixel came out, even though, it's excuse me, so much a better device. Now I'm actually seeing Pixel 2s around. Who knows what that extrapolates into, but that's a good start for Google because that has not been a given with any of its releases.
Yeah. And it does seem like at least most of the major issues with the hardware or the software have been fixed, I guess. There have been so many, and many of them have been very minor, but we've reported on quite a few, and with the November and December security patches, they seem to have largely been fixed. I don't think the XL will ever be considered to have a great screen, but I think, and Andrew and I have said this many times, the saturated color setting, I think, fixes at least a lot of what we perceive as to be poor color representation on the Pixel 2 XL, even though that setting makes colors incredibly inaccurate. It's just more pleasing to the eye. Mm. But I don't see people complaining about the screen nearly as much anymore.
No, not at all. I mean, I'm certainly done complaining about it. It's such a dead horse at this point.
So, speaking of like phones that have been gaining momentum, and especially through word of mouth, the OnePlus 5T came out last month, and it's been doing, or is it 2 months ago? Was it? I can't even remember.
It was last month.
Last month.
Okay. Time's flying. And the release was successful. OnePlus once again had enough stock for everybody, and it's a $500 phone, does everything a more expensive phone would do. This week in India and parts of like the Nordic region, for some reason, OnePlus announced the Star Wars limited edition OnePlus 5T. Alex, have you seen it, or you were just working with Harish on this, right?
So I was working with Harish on the video for this, and I've not seen it in person, but from hearing from him, it's kind of interesting. And obviously you have your Star Wars branding on there, you have the exclusive themes and some color tweaks, and a case that looks like Kylo Ren's mask, which is kind of crazy. If you watch our video, you'll see that. Biggest thing for me about this is actually the finish of the metal itself. They're going back to this sandstone finish on the back of it in a white color, and we'll see how well that ages. But perhaps a little bit worrying there as to how many, what kind of knocks and scrapes you'll pick up on there. But it's you're going for not only a very different color for the original 5T, but a very different feel as well. You're going back to the feel of the original OnePlus 1, OnePlus 2. So obviously it's a very limited release. I think India is one of the markets they're trying to push into in a big way. The Nordic countries, I think it was Sweden where they had one of their very first carrier partners, and they found quite big early success there, so maybe that's why they're doing it there as well. Obviously, licensing and money will come into that equation as well, but it's interesting to see them going back into what has been kind of their trademark finish there, and we'll just have to see what happens. One interesting thing to note, Harish has been using this for the past few days before the announcement yesterday, and was actually using it in the same pocket as a Pixel 2 XL. And don't put a foam with sandstone finish in this and metal underneath that on in the same pocket as a Pixel 2, and certainly don't have that sandstone finish facing the screen of the Pixel 2, because you'll have a bad time if you do that.
That sandstone finish is grippy. I've had it actually like tear up jeans pockets.
Yep.
It's real, especially when you have it on a case, because it's wrapped all the way around. That stuff is killer.
And the picture that Harish posted of his Pixel 2 XL after it had been in his pocket for a few minutes with this 5T, it looked like it had been, you know, a power sander had been taken to it or something. It was really, really rough. And I guess not just other phones, but maybe, you know, coffee tables, other things. You want to be careful about what you put this phone down on. I guess by extension, maybe cases that use that material as well.
I could see that thing ruin the top layer of like a glass table if you really tossed it on there.
Although, I mean, cool, if you have any imperfections, you could just use it to sand it down and get something really nice and smooth. So
work in a paint shop or something, you know.
You could save a couple dollars and just don't buy any sandpaper. Just use the back of this phone on something. It'd be pretty good.
A good investment there.
$600. So
if OnePlus had any kind of common sense at all as far as attracting a U.S. audience, they would listen to this podcast and send one of these phones to like Nick Offerman and try and get a video of him using it in his wood shop, like as an actual tool. That would be the best video.
I would definitely watch that video once. I love the look of this phone. I love the red mute switch.
The accent colors are cool.
I love that this is the year of accent colors. It's like I think this started with the Next Bit Robin a little bit.
HTC was doing it back with some of the, I forget, it was
mostly
one of the,
with the Desires.
Yeah, with the Desire phones. I think with one of the Droid phones back then. You can probably draw a straight line from there through Scott Croyle eventually to Next Bit. But I'm sure HTC did that with red back in the day.
The first Droid Incredible and things like that, they were really like murdered out, but then had red accents all around it.
Yeah, I keep having to stop myself from buying another Pixel 2, this one in kind of blue. Like I go to the store, I put it in my cart, and then I have to, you know, Command W every time, because it's just, it's very, very hard not to buy that phone.
Eeyore blue.
It's so good. I love it. I'll trade you, Russell. I will trade you. I'll even throw in like some Canadian, you know, maple syrup or something.
Say Canadian dollars, because that's bacon. Not really worth anything.
The syrup is probably more valuable, right?
Exactly. You don't want Canadian dollars. As Andrew can attest, it is very difficult to send money across the border because Amazon.com is like half the price of Amazon.ca. But buying something and getting it and getting reimbursed, it's like two different countries. It's so annoying. God. Just politics. Have one currency for the whole world. How hard would that be?
Pretty hard.
Alex is sitting there going, well, my currency is worth twice as much as both of yours, so shut the hell up. This is not coming to the US anytime soon, but let's hope. I mean, I'm sure you can import it. It's probably on eBay for like $1,000 right now. So,
yeah, I saw some were going up on eBay for like $750, stuff like that.
Don't we have a man on the inside who can just hook us up with a couple?
Actually, it's kind of interesting. I'm not sure about getting phones out of India, but getting electronics into India is notoriously difficult. And actually, they pay huge import tariffs, which is why a lot of companies actually manufacture inside of India. You probably have better luck getting one of the Nordic units, I guess. But we don't have anyone on the inside there.
Not yet.
We need to find someone.
Wait until Marcus is visiting Sweden, maybe.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yes. The owner of Mobile Nations is Swedish, so we should have an inside there. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about Star Wars itself. I just kind of want to geek out with Russell for a minute. Spoiler free, I promise. But so both of us saw this last night, and I do think it was the best Star Wars film since Empire. Would you agree with that?
It was by far the most fun Star Wars movie of the entire set. Like, yes. it was just an amazingly fun movie. And I feel like my only real criticism of the movie was that the comedy was maybe just a hair over the top. But it was just a fun movie from beginning to end.
I would agree with that. I think it is, there are a couple of scenes in the film where everybody in the theater just started clapping.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Like at least three times people were just like uproariously cheering. And I don't remember that at all from The Force Awakens. Like,
no,
that was a good movie. I enjoyed it, but this was like, there were parts of it where everybody just, it was just happy. It was like the filmmakers, the actors, everybody doing, everybody involved in the film just seemed to be having fun. And I don't know if that can be attributed directly to director Rian Johnson, but I would like to think that he had a big role to play given that he wrote and directed the film, but also just that all of his other films are like quality films. Like, they're just great, intelligent kind of, I don't know, they're deep and they're fun and they're interesting. And I think he brought a lot of that here.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I loved, you know, what was done with the individual characters as far as their personal development. I am obsessed with some of the new characters that got introduced, that they weren't just, tag-alongs with the original cast. You know, we saw one character in particular who, seemed like they were going to be this kind of background character, and I'm pretty sure that they are now a major part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really happy to see all of that. I love that the bad guy, we got a lot more definition. Supreme Leader Snoke is not just a weird hologram.
Yeah, I don't think that's a spoiler.
No,
at all. I think
no, because you saw his physical form in the trailers, but I'm glad that there's a lot more to that character. I was hoping that this wasn't just going to be like this ominous shadow for an entire another movie.
Yeah, I did find it a bit weird when Kylo Ren pulled out a 1+5T to make a phone call.
That was super weird. And
yeah, that was,
I gotta say,
me out of the film a bit.
Like, it was downright brave for them to decide that Adam Driver needed to do a full nude scene. Like, that was unusual, but I'm not gonna hold it against him.
That bod, man. So, you gotta work what you have. So
at least they had some quality porg placement to make sure that we didn't see any bits we weren't supposed to.
He was very gentle with those porgs. It was okay. That's just wrong. All right, let's move on. Let's thank our first sponsor of the show, or second sponsor. Let's thank Thrifter for being a part of the Android Central podcast. As we do every week, we go to thrifter.com. And we use their very easy to find search feature to find a deal that speaks to us personally on a deep level, one that changes us for the better. Given that Russell is on the same wavelength as me on Star Wars, I will let him go first. What is your pick for this week?
This one actually hit me really close to home. I had to buy it as soon as I saw it. The Logitech MX Ergo trackball. This is the first time that Logitech has updated their big trackball in, I guess, like 10 years. And I need a trackball. Like, I physically need one in order to use my computer. And I have had...
I did not know you were a trackball person.
Yeah, it's cool. Because of the nerve damage in my right hand. I've had the M570, the wireless one with the blue trackball, for forever. I've bought probably four or five of these, because when they die, like, that's just... It's still the best one. But they made so many changes to the MX series to make it ergonomic and to give me a lot more like position control, and some of the changes that they've made to the trackball. The only problem that I had was that I wasn't really ready to shell out like the $120 for a new trackball when mine was still working just fine. But Thrifter pointed out that it was on sale. It's actually $90. It was the first time that it had received a discount. So now I own one.
Yeah, I love this thing. I'm never used a trackball before. I have one.
I didn't know that.
It's very interesting because you can use it in two orientations, and depending on which one suits your hand better. But I find this whenever I'm not on a laptop, like if I'm working at a desk for a long time, I will attach this. And because it uses Logitech's unifying technology, you can just plug in that USB stick and it can connect to all of your Logitech accessories, or you can just attach it using Bluetooth. So it's pretty versatile. I agree with this. And it works on Windows and Mac. Alex, what are you looking at this week?
So I'm looking at kind of a basic bread and butter sort of Android thing. We're looking at 32 gig Moto G5 Plus, $175 on B&H. I reviewed this phone many months ago. I think we still have to agree it's one of the best entry-level Android phones you can buy, mainly because of the build quality, because of Moto's software experience. $175 with a $25 coupon, crazy good value for money. And just a great phone at that price point, I think.
100% agree. Still, that was in my favorite, like my best of tech list for the year.
Mm-hmm.
Totally, totally worth it, especially at $175. Andrew, what's speaking to you?
I didn't even know they made these. I'm looking at the 12 South Plug Bug, which is this weirdly named thing that adapts your MacBook wall charger to add another USB port. But this one is also an international adapter. So it's this thing you clip on the top of your MacBook wall charger, gives you an extra USB port, and gives you, what is it, 5 different international plugs to be able to adapt it to. And now since Apple super cheaped out and doesn't give you an extension cable for your MacBook wall charger, I'm going to have just a wall charger anyway. And the thing is $36, which is a really good deal. Rather than having to carry around those stupid adapters when we go over to Europe, this might be a good way to go. And they even have a gigantic, funky UK one too, Alex.
Cool.
I like that. I agree that Apple needs to up its charger inclusion game, especially since, Alex, earlier this week you were rightfully lambasting the company for charging £20 for its CETA Lightning
cord. That was Google, and that was
which is the same price as the CETA Apple, yeah, or no, the Apple CETA Lightning,
and
one.
it wasn't even a C2C, it was an A to C cable. It was like your most basic bog standard phone charging cable for 2017, £20.
Oh, well, I must have been jet lagged, but yeah, that's still a terrible idea. Either way, cables, spending too much on them is like, it hurts me. Okay. So this one's kind of out of left field, but I will attest to its necessity for any dog owner. Cutting my dog's nails or like is impossible. My dog is 115 pounds and she hates it. And the one thing that I found that is slightly less, it's not as like annoying for her, and it stresses her out a lot less, is a Dremel pet grooming kit. This sounds like it would be actually quite harsh, but it's not. And basically what it is, it uses sort of a guide to smooth out your dog's nails instead of like actually cutting them off, because it's quite easy to cut them at an angle that hurts the dog, or you can get to that point where you actually hit a nerve and it starts bleeding. This makes it really easy. It's a $25 pet grooming kit, down from $32. And I really like, I highly recommend this for somebody who has a very uneasy dog when it comes to grooming, or you just don't want to spend like $40 to go to the groomer to get, you know, his or her nails cut. Do it yourself.
Let me tell you about how terrified I was the first time that blood came out of my dog's fingernail.
Yeah.
I did not know that was a thing that happened, because there is no like guide to owning a dog. And so, yeah, I, up until very, very recently, I was just like, no, you get to go to the groomer when it's time to get nails done, because I am never living through that horrifying experience again. But you're right. These things, like, it's super, super easy to do.
Yeah, and it's not like some saw that makes a really high-pitched, you know, wheezing or squealing sound. Like, this is a very, it's not calming, but it's less intimidating than it sounds putting a very fast-moving saw near your
dog. Yeah, I feel like the name Dremel implies some tension there that isn't actually there.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, $25, I think it's pretty good if you own a dog. And thank you, Thrifter, for sponsoring the show. And if you want to learn more, go to thrifter.com and sign up for their daily newsletter. You can get all the great deals in your inbox every morning. All right, so let's continue. Andrew, you reported this earlier in the week. Synaptics preempted everybody, essentially, saying that it is now ready to ship a under-the-glass fingerprint sensor, and that mm-hmm. a top five smartphone manufacturer would have it in its phone next year. Without naming that manufacturer, giving us all reason to speculate which one it would be. Obviously, top five means it could only be, you know, Apple, Samsung, Huawei, Oppo, or Vivo. Or depending if you leave Apple out, LG as well.
I'm sorry, what was that fifth one?
What? Say,
what was that fifth one?
Or Vivo?
Vivo. Vivo? Is that, how do you say that?
They're seriously a top five company?
Oh, they're like top two. No,
they are the top five. They are number five, which is why when you say top five, you just look at which one is number five, because obviously you're going to pick the highest number you can when you're announcing that.
So, turns out it is Vivo, and this is coming to a phone early next year.
Coming to a phone not near you.
Exactly, because Vivo is not
listening to this broadcast
outside of China. However, Andrew, what are you making of this? So this is a pretty big deal, I would say. This is a technology that every company from Samsung to Apple to Huawei, I'm sure, has been experimenting with.
Yeah.
And it's here. It works. What do you think?
This is pretty dope, as the kids would say. I think that it makes a whole lot of sense. This is just the next evolution of fingerprint sensors. Just like we're seeing all these manufacturers take the headphone jack out because it's one more thing that they have to put inside the phone and one more thing to, you know, have potentially fail or be a point of, you know, water and dust and things getting in the phone. A fingerprint sensor, as Samsung has shown, is just another thing you have to worry about, you know, fitting into your phone design. And it may not seem like it's that big of a deal, but anytime you have an opportunity to remove something like that and put it, you know, as part of the kind of substructure of a display right underneath the glass, you do it every single day of the week. And Synaptics claims that it is indistinguishable from putting your finger on what is already a glass-covered fingerprint sensor somewhere else on the phone. And the cool thing about it is that you can just enable it and disable it on the fly. So whenever you get that prompt on the screen that says place your finger on the fingerprint sensor, that will be tied to activating that area, you know, not the specific area on, you know, where the interface shows up, but a defined area on the screen that's your fingerprint sensor. You put your finger there, and then after it authenticates, it's gone again. This is like the holy grail of what manufacturers are all trying to do. And like you said, you know that they're all working on this and getting it up to their, you know, cost levels and tolerance levels and all those kind of things. But Synaptics, obviously not a company that we're talking about all the time, but as the, you know, a well-known company that's been doing this type of authentication stuff for years and years, it's not surprising that they're trying to grab a little bit of, you know, a little bit of news by saying, hey, we're going to do it, and we're doing it really soon.
So a couple of things there for me. First thing is the reason, well, one of the main reasons why Samsung and Apple didn't do this last year is because you could put it in there, but you'd be able to basically see where it was in the screen. So there would be a difference in the brightness of pixels around the area where that fingerprint sensor was. I don't think we've had a conclusive answer yet as to whether this, you know, Synaptics Vivo partnership has solved that issue. And obviously, there are also questions around what are the yields for this kind of technology. Big reason why a larger manufacturer, like say Apple or Samsung, might not want to include this in their phone is if the yields just aren't up there to where you would need to be for this to ship in a Galaxy S phone, which would, you know, be in the tens of millions of units shipped. So, yeah, obviously they can now do this in a phone. They're going to be shipping it in a phone. But I think people are going to be looking really close at the area in the screen where that sensor is to try and say, is there any sort of visual compromise of having that sensor in there? Can you see it below the backlight or below the LEDs? And also, you know, when eventually Samsung gets it, are the yields up to the level where it's not going to cause issues in the supply chain?
Right. So Patrick Moorhead, an analyst with Moore Insights, got access to a prototype version of this in a Vivo phone. He wrote about it for Forbes, and as dubious as Forbes, you know, reputation is for these kinds of articles, Patrick Moorhead is a very, very trustworthy person. I've spoken to him many times on other issues, and he is saying that he's kind of addressed both of those points, Alex. He said that it uses the sensor is a CMOS image sensor. So it's actually basically like a camera sensor similar to it. And it uses the OLED display itself to eliminate the fingerprint. So it doesn't, so obviously there is a potential for you to see the underlying technology, but clearly they've figured that out. And the screen itself isn't going to be brighter because it uses the OLED display to light it up.
Which is an ingenious way to do it. That's awesome.
But then you need a good enough OLED display with tolerances like we have with current generation Samsung OLED displays that would allow for, like, you basically have to have a perfect OLED display with completely uniform lighting. So you can't have, like, LG's displays for the V30 and the Pixel 2 XL just probably wouldn't be good enough.
I mean, I think perfect is maybe overselling it. The way you get a uniform look to an OLED panel is just by calibration. That's not hard, but it does take money to do that. That's something that I think, if you remember our podcast, when we were talking to Daniel Matty a few weeks back, it's part of the manufacturing process that costs money. It's something that some OLED screens do that I think the Pixel 2 XL doesn't. It just means during manufacturing, you look at it, you get all the pixels, you calibrate them to the point where they look right. But that's just another expense that goes into manufacturing the phone.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, at the same time, Samsung has also been able to make its screens considerably brighter. And, you know, that's another advantage. So, we'll see. I think you're absolutely right. This could be a game changer for Android OEMs. Other thing that Moorhead says is that they're expecting total shipments to be in, you know, up to 70 million, which is potentially enough for a Samsung or a Huawei. So,
That's kind of interesting given the numbers. Probably not an Apple then if it's only 70 million.
Well, I mean, that's a question, right? Like, do you think Apple would revert back to this technology after going all in on Face ID? I really don't see them making
70 million of them. I mean, that's like, if it was only 70 million going to Apple, maybe, but if it's going to be potentially Samsung further down the line, you know, Huawei's going to want to get in on that. Yeah, it's going to be tough. And Apple, of course, has already invested a huge amount of money into making Face ID a thing and pushing that. So, yeah, probably not.
There's way more incentive for Android manufacturers to get in on this, as we've previously talked about. You know, the Android only has good authentication APIs set up for fingerprint. And if you want to try to do anything other than that, it's going to be rolling your own, and that's just a whole world of hurt.
Yeah, although I think it's a fairly safe bet that Android P will have facial biometric APIs included. You know, I don't see why Google wouldn't include that. But then again, maybe they'll just ignore it completely and leave it to the OEMs. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, the other possibility here is that companies will just continue using what they know. And fingerprint sensors, when placed properly on the back of a phone, work, right? We know this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, most of the phones I've been using this year have had fingerprint scanners on the back. And whether I'm reaching for, you know, the U11 Plus or Pixel 2 XL, very quickly muscle memory kicks in. You don't even think about reaching your finger to the same point on the back of the phone and just unlocking it instantly. A little bit more problematic when it's face down on the surface, but to be honest, you just get used to picking it up. You get used to, you're going to probably, unless you're just checking notifications, you're going to pick it up anyway. I don't know. I don't see this as a huge thing. I think for phones that still want to have that fingerprint sensor on the front, it's going to be a huge marketing point, I'm sure, at some point this year. But just to, from a purely, you know, convenience angle, you know, for me, it isn't going to revolutionize the way I use a phone.
No, I don't even think it's a convenience thing in any way. I think it's purely a manufacturer driven thing. They would far prefer to just have something that they can pay a quick licensing fee, which, by the way, they're already paying some sort of licensing fees for these other types of sensors. They're not all making these in-house. It just makes more sense if it's something they can put into the display subsystem rather than having to have a separate physical sensor that needs to be connected to the main board, cut a piece out of the back of the phone. They would way prefer to just have it built right into the display. And if they can, you know, come out break even on cost there and cut down on a potential failure point, manufacturers are going to jump all over it.
Yeah, I mean, there is still a separate sensor that goes under the screen, but that sensor can't be scratched. It's impervious to water and dust. You know, these are good things. It could potentially lower costs. And it's also very reliable. Your finger can be wet, unlike with current sensors, because it's basically just taking a picture of your fingerprint and confirming it with the secure element, you know, whatever semantic synaptics is using. So this does sound like a bit more of a foolproof solution. The only thing is you need an OLED screen, and we're getting there. I mean, most Android OEMs have transitioned to OLED, right? I think HTC is the biggest holdout, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, it Sony. Depends what LG does with the G6 successor,
yeah,
right?
LG Display is still making a lot of LCDs alongside OLED, and actually LG Display's LCD is considerably more mature at this point than their OLED stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't see LG going back to... I don't see the G7, for instance, having an LCD display.
I would say 50-50 on that, probably. Given the trouble they've had towards the end of this year with some phones. But yeah, I mean, going forward for sure, you know, there are a lot of advantages to OLED in power consumption and display quality and everything else.
So Daniel Matte did say, though, that LG was on the verge of launching a new manufacturing facility with a more mature OLED process, but
yeah,
didn't get to it
in
time.
That was originally posted on like some random Reddit post that I think he was able to confirm. I guess it just, from that perspective, it depends when that kicks in next year, whether it's in time for the G6 for LG or whether it comes later in that year for, you know, potentially a Pixel or a V40 later in 2018.
And then there's the other thing with the G7. Will it get the Snapdragon 845, or will it do what the G6 did this year and include, you know, the previous year's Snapdragon?
I mean, that's kind of a really interesting question for LG as a manufacturer, and just with what they've done with the V series now, where it is much more of a mainstream phone. It's less of this gigantic brick. It's a 6-inch phone, but it's 18x9. It doesn't feel like a large phone to use. It kind of encroaches on the territory that has traditionally been, has belonged to the G series. Obviously, G6 wasn't a huge seller. Part of that was because, you know, it had like a month of relevance before it got steamrolled by the Galaxy S8. Is it going to be worth LG trying the same thing again with another 835 powered phone versus just holding out later and maybe, I don't know, shifting gears towards the V series? No easy answer there for them. But I think if they do, obviously, you know, the rumor was that Samsung has secured the first batch of 845s. So either they wait until later, or they try and hit the same time frame in the year as they have the G6 last year, and they use the older CPU, but then they try and do something else to differentiate the G series, and, you know, have that carve out its own position in the market. I only time will tell. And I'm not really sure what LG could do at this stage in a smaller phone, you know, when they've made a couple great phones this past year that haven't really moved the needle for them.
So you mentioned the Samsung behemoth that was the S8. A couple new things with Samsung this week. You took a look at the upcoming Oreo update for the S8 and S8 Plus and Note 8. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we'll get it too. And we saw our first CAD renders of the Galaxy S9 with a redesigned camera and fingerprint. What does that all tell you about what we can expect? Obviously, there were rumors that the S9 would be seen at CES. That's been rebuffed a little bit. I highly doubt we'll see it, but who knows?
We kind of covered that last week in terms of whether we'll actually see it or whether it'll be teased. And to sort of repeat what I said there, there's a lot of reason to suspect that there'll be quite a strong teaser there. Will we see the phone in its entirety? Probably not. Maybe a silhouette. That's probably, you know, most we can hope for.
Exactly. So, but with now that we've seen, Oreo on the S8 and the first renders of the S9, what are your thoughts on that?
So the big takeaway in that respect is that this is a talk year for Samsung. You have the TikTok cycle where you had S6 and S7, and the S7 wasn't drastically different from the S6, but you had like a few key sort of improvements and just a lot of iterative updates that took that core design and built upon it in ways that made sense. I think that's what we're dealing with here with the jump from S8 to S9. And that again ties into what we were hearing a few weeks back from Evan Blass, that there wouldn't really be any drastic design changes in this new generation of Samsung phones. So, and again, that plays out in what we've seen from the Oreo update and Samsung Experience version 9, as we have it in the current beta release for the S8. So, the basic experience of using a Galaxy S8 hasn't changed at all. There are some software tweaks, like the edge lighting feature has been improved. There are some new clock widgets. All the Oreo stuff that you would expect is there. So, the icon cutouts now work a little bit better. They're still squircles, but it just is a little bit more consistent with the way it works with a lot of icons. But, you know, if you were to get this OTA and you weren't really aware, you didn't really care about Android versions or anything, your GS8 would still function as a GS8. Biggest thing you probably notice is it just seems faster to use. And actually, a lot of this probably is down to the difference and a lot of the tweaks that were made around touch responsiveness going from 7.0 to 7.1 that obviously the Galaxy S8 didn't get because it's still on 7.0. The performance improvements that you see in the Note, which is on 7.1, of course, it gets all of this stuff on 8.0. It's just a little bit faster to use. It doesn't quite seem to have the sort of bit rot that a lot of older Samsung phones get with age. And same core experience. You get all the Oreo features like picture-in-picture mode, and it is just that little bit faster to use. And that's probably what we can expect on the software side for the most part in the S9. Maybe there'll be some surprises later on. There are obvious hardware things that they could improve. Display quality, you know, fingerprint placement, it would be hard to get that worse than it was in the S8. Dual camera potentially could be a thing for, especially for the larger of the two, is rumored. And just improvements to computational photography in general. Obvious to see how that could work, given everything Google's been doing in that field. So probably won't look a whole lot different to the phones that we currently have, the S8 and S8 Plus, but it's going to be about what's going on under the hood and what they can do to improve features.
That's a lot. I mean,
it's a lot, yeah.
It is a lot. But I'm really, I don't know, like maybe, you know, we've been spoiled with the Pixel 2's camera, but I really just hope that Samsung, the S8's camera is fantastic, but I just hope that they really continue to improve on low light photography, because that I think that's really the only place that Samsung is falling behind.
The sort of high dynamic range, the situations where it isn't just about capturing light and putting it on a sensor. It's about what you do with that information after the fact. Google is ahead of everyone in terms of that computational photography. And I think maybe this generation, if you're Samsung, you take what is already a very good sensor and lens combo. And actually, in terms of the optics, very little difference between Galaxy S8's camera and the Pixel's camera. It's about what Google does with that information after the fact. Maybe right. That's the area that Samsung focuses on this year.
Anybody else? Is this kind of a...
I am in full agreement.
It is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, I've been using the Note 8 the last couple weeks to try to do a little bit of a refresh take on it, and I'd kind of forgotten, I guess, how good the camera still is. The cameras, I guess you could say.
I mean, because still, you know, we've all been what, 4 months.
Yeah, still. But I mean, we've all been so smitten with the Pixel 2 and 2 XL, which we should be because the cameras are fantastic. But you know, it kind of made us forget, you know, how good Samsung's been for months and months. I mean, I say still as well because we're talking about the Galaxy S8's camera, effectively, and that's just the one shortcoming is. Just kind of how it handles smoothing out and managing metering in those dark situations. But it's still a fantastic camera.
Yeah, that's true. Can't go wrong. They're still the most popular phones in the world, so we can't forget that. We talk a lot about the Pixel 2's camera, but the reality is that people are buying the Galaxy S8. So,
good phone.
Solid. All right, let's move on to our last sponsor of the day and talk about GameStash. We've spoken about GameStash every week, and it just keeps getting better and better. So this is a service where you pay $5 a month and you get access to hundreds of premium Android games on your phone or tablet. Do you remember those Android tablets? Well, it works on your tablet. And some of those games are fantastic. We've re-reviewed a bunch of them on AC. Games like Evoland, Badland, King of Thieves, even Cut the Rope 2, super fun games. And there's tons of kids content as well. So if you're looking just to, let's be honest, give your kid a phone for a few minutes to pass the time to get them to, you know, stop doing what they're doing, then this is a great service for that. There is a 2-week free trial. If you don't want to commit, there is no obligation. You can cancel at any time and you will not be charged a penny. But after that 14-day trial, it is just $5. And if you want to give it a try, you can go to gamestash.com/acpod. That is gamestash.com/acpod and sign up right there. And we thank GameStash for their continued support of the AC podcast. All right, guys. We're getting to the end of the show, and we kind of have to talk about this thing that happened yesterday. And, you know, if you're on the internet at all, I'm sure you've heard about it, even if you're not in the US, and that is the repeal of the net neutrality laws that were passed in 2015. They're gone, and that's it. But it's not over, and I think that's really what it comes down to, right? There have been a bunch of lawsuits, you know, issued. They were issued like the moment the law was repealed.
Right? Yeah, they were ready to go.
And especially in California, attorneys general in California and New York have issued lawsuits. They will also be looking into starting sort of a state by state net neutrality provision where the actual legislatures in those states will uphold net neutrality in whatever way that their, you know, Congress sees fit. And I don't think that's a great solution, but it'll probably be better than nothing, right?
Yeah, and there's always this interesting thing that happens, not just in this type of stuff, but all kinds of laws where if you have, you know, New York State and California start doing things, it pushes a lot of companies to have to apply those things to entire regions, if not the entire country, because of the amount of population and number of customers in those areas. So when they kind of, those states lead by example, it makes an oversized impact on what companies can do. I mean, we see this all the time in the auto industry when California decides it wants to have a really strong law about something pertaining to the auto industry. Everyone else, you know, they have to follow and all the different states because they can't provide different products in different states.
Similar deal with the Paris Climate Agreement, right? With states going their own way on that. Mm-hmm.
So you know, this has been a long time coming. The repeal happened on party lines. Three Republicans chose to repeal, and the two Democratic commissioners dissented. And both Democratic FCC commissioners were emphatic in their in their just sheer dismay of what happened. I think most people on the internet agree that repealing net neutrality was not in the best interests of U.S. consumers. But there we go. So there's going to be a lot happening in the weeks and months to come.
And I think you made the important point right off the start there that this is not over. It's also not something to think that the rug is being pulled out from under you. The sky is falling. The world is, you know, descending into madness. There's fortunately, this is just how this works. It's going to take time for things to actually happen for real. So don't think that your defense, well, not defense, I guess is more of an offensive measure at this point, is just over. You still have, you know, there are lots of opportunities for your representatives to continue to go against this.
Yeah, and I mean, before net neutrality was put into place, there were examples of carriers that were pushing the boundaries to see what they could get away with. And there was either public pushback or acceptance. And in the instance of the beginnings of T-Mobile's zero rating policies, Russell, you wrote about this in 2014.
Oh, did I? Did I like once or five times?
That was one of the most entertaining series of articles I read when I started at Mobile Nations, was your complete like teardown of John Legere and T-Mobile back when Music Unlimited, is that what it was called? Music Unlimited?
Yeah.
And Binge On started, and how difficult they were making it for smaller companies to get on board, and how they were partnering with like three different companies at the beginning. What were the other things that T-Mobile was doing?
They started zero rating video content that they thought was cool, and then they forcibly enabled 480p streaming by default without telling anybody how to turn it off. Mm-hmm. There's been a forced zero rating of YouTube's content, even when you did turn it off, and then they tried to act like it was YouTube's fault for it happening. There was quite a few things that T-Mobile did throughout the process of building their little network, and the entire time it was kind of like, hey, this really sucks, and our audience in particular dropped into the comments and totally stuck up for that scrappy upstart that totally isn't, you know, a major corporation.
Yeah.
And so yeah, we've been building up to this for a while, and you know, it's there's always an argument for competition anytime something like this happens. I'm gonna be as brief as possible for this, because we could have a whole another podcast where I just kind of scream into the microphone. But you know, if you take a look at how we got here, it's really not hard to see how some of this is going to be viewed as a good thing in the long term for some people.
Potentially, I think if you're already on a fairly generous plan, you will get some short-term benefits, I suppose. Like, zero rating can be seen as a consumer benefit. That, and zero rating is the process of not making certain types of data or data from certain services count towards a cap. And there are, in the U.S., they kind of did away with zero rating entirely by just going all in on unlimited. So you're only throttled when you get to like 22 to 50 gigabytes of data per month, depending on the carrier. Zero rating isn't really a thing anymore, because you're not counting pennies the way that you used to. But there's still that. I mean, T-Mobile, for instance, with T-Mobile One, defaults to 480p video streams unless you pay $10 a month extra. Verizon does the same thing. AT&T does the same thing. I think Sprint is the only one that still allows you to do 1080p by default, and that's because it's Sprint. So, yeah, we'll see a lot of the carriers pushing the boundaries a little bit. There's a lot of consolidation in the works. Obviously, AT&T is attempting to buy Time Warner, which owns so much content that people love, including HBO, that can you imagine what could happen if HBO starts getting paywalled to anybody who isn't an AT&T subscriber, or gets, you know, less likely than being completely paywalled is, or not paywalled, but stonewalled, is to like charge Comcast customers like double what AT&T customers get charged, things like that. You know, it's not likely to happen overnight, but there is the potential that that could happen. So stay tuned for that. I don't know. Do you guys have anything else to say about this before we sign off for the week?
Well, I think that's such an important, that final point there is very important, that it's kind of this uncertainty that's like kind of the most, like the scariest thing about it is it could be kind of bad. It could be really bad. And you don't really know. So that always leads to the worst case scenario examples, which in many cases can be valid, but it's just kind of like, that's what's super scary about it is you don't necessarily know, but that's why I try to hope to get people to just take a little bit more of a level-headed approach that like this isn't cemented forever and it can be changed. And it's not necessarily going to be your worst case scenario. Like, and a little bit more to that point, it's like HBO costing twice as much if you're on Verizon is like, it's such a small part of what could go wrong with this situation. Like HBO costing twice as much on Verizon shouldn't even be like an example of something bad happening. Like, on the grand scheme of having internet access for everyone in the US, like who the hell cares about HBO costing twice as much? There are just like larger discussions and that type of stuff happening around net neutrality rules.
And if that worst case scenario does eventually come, like almost by the rules of how these things tend to work, it won't happen anytime soon. It'll be this slow build up to it. It'll be the, you know, the old analogy with the frog in the pot of boiling water. The heat will eventually go up to the point where, you know, these things will pile on progressively to the point where eventually you will reach this obnoxious level where ownership of content, there'll be this perfect storm where it will become actually really quite onerous compared to what it was before. And it just, you know, we'll have to wait and see, given the way things are right now.
Yeah, and absolutely, you're absolutely right, Andrew. It's not, you're not gonna, I mean, rich people are gonna be able to pay for services because they're rich and they can spend twice as much on HBO. Doesn't matter if it's $40 or $20, they'll pay for it. It's the potential blocking of access to for you know, lower income families, for people who can barely afford broadband as it is, for you know, essential services. Like, you know, what happens if
we even have access to broadband in any way?
Right. I mean, what happens if Wikimedia, which owns Wikipedia, gets throttled or blocked by a carrier, by a company that doesn't like the content that's hosting it, that it's hosting? These are services that could be potentially, you know, devastating for people who don't have access to alternate, you know, alternate services. So, you know, again, this is, I don't mean to say that there are imminent nightmare scenarios going to happen tomorrow. And Andrew's right, you should have a level head on this, but you should also try to educate yourself. And we're going to do the same on what will and can happen in light of these changes. So I think we're going to leave it there. and we'll discuss this probably every week for the next little while. We're going to have a show next week, and the week after that, we may have a show, we may not, but
we need to look at a calendar.
And then it's back into CES. So the next few weeks, it's not going to slow down. So let's leave it there, guys. Thank you for being awesome.
Yeah, this was a super positive podcast that ended really solemnly. It was
true.
It's good.
I put lots of porgs on my desk during the podcast.
Saw that.
Yeah. Follow Andrew Martinick. Follow Alex Dobie. Follow Russell Hawley. Good thing you guys all have normal Twitter handles, so you can just look them up. My name is Daniel Bader. And thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
See you. So long.
See you later.